The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spergata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article by Lee Haber is titled, Misty Copeland Says Movies Like Black Swan Get Ballerinas All Wrong. Before discovering ballet at age 13, Misty Copeland was a shy girl. After her mother's various divorces and breakups with boyfriends, she spent most of her childhood moving from place to place with her mother and five siblings. She'd had no exposure to ballet, and certainly no dreams of becoming a prima ballerina, or the first black woman to become principal dancer for New York's elite American Ballet Theater. Today, Misty Copeland is an icon and inspiration, with a burning passion for bringing more people of color into the ballet world, both as dancers and as fans. Copeland's third book, her first is a best-selling memoir, 2014's A Life in Motion, An Unlikely Ballerina, and the second, a children's book called Firebird, is out now. It's another illustrated children's book entitled Bunheads, which tells the story of a young dancer named Misty, who falls in love with dance through her role in the ballet Coppelia, an actual ballet Misty Copeland has danced. Through that role, the Misty of Bunheads finds her confidence, her voice, and her life's work. O's Books editor Lee Haber spoke with Copeland to discuss her new book, Life During the Coronavirus Pandemic, and why she recently shared a stage with Taylor Swift. Why are ballet dancers called bunheads? Dancers put in many hours of training and are always running back and forth from home to school or the studio. When I think of them, of us, it's with little shorts on, with street clothes on over tights, their hair up in buns. You can spot them from a mile away. You know a ballet dancer when you see one, and they're referred to as bunheads. It's an actual term we use in our community, and I felt it was such a cute and endearing way to introduce this group of characters to readers. All my characters are based on real people, and my relationships with them coming of age in a ballet studio. Can you describe that moment when you discovered ballet and began to think, this is what I'm in love with? While I wanted to capture the essence of my actual experience in Bunheads, it's not exactly how I was introduced to ballet. I was at the Boys and Girls Club at my community center when I was 13. Ballet wasn't something I knew about or had any interest in. I was drawn to dance, but the only dance I knew was on BET, MTV, and VH1. There was a free ballet class being offered, which was being taught on a basketball court. I was pushed into taking the class as they thought, having seen me dance on my own, that I had the ability. At first, stepping onto a basketball court to learn ballet was mortifying. I was an introverted child and had experienced a lot of trauma. Ballet was way outside my comfort zone. But my teacher told me she'd never seen talent like mine. Also, she noted that I had a small head, sloping shoulders, long legs, and big feet of the typical ballerina. Soon she was calling me a prodigy and offering me a full scholarship to study at her school, a proper studio. What happened when you started training at the studio? The first time that I put on the tights and the leotard and the ballet slippers and stepped into a studio with barres lining the walls and mirrors on the wall was the first time that I realized my power and the voice that I had without speaking. At that time, speaking was something I avoided at all costs, but I found I could express myself through movement. I looked in the mirror and it was the first time I was being told that I was good at something and that I was beautiful. I wanted to capture that with my Bunheads protagonist, also named Misty. Though the fictional Misty's introduction to ballet is a little different from mine, she immediately falls in love with ballet too. A lot of that has to do with the relationship she was creating within the studio, which is what happened to me. There's a girl named Kat in your book, another dancer. Was there a Kat in your experience, a young colleague or mentor? Yes, my best friend growing up, and probably the first friend I met at the studio, was named Catalina, a young Mexican-American girl. We called her Cat. She was such a big part of my growing up. I'm one of six children, and my siblings were my everything. But I didn't have close friends outside my brothers and sisters before ballet. How are you and Kat different? Kat was really outgoing. I think she was 2 or 3 years younger than me, but she was so mature, and she just kind of took me under her wing. She'd been dancing her whole life. The first time I met Kat, I was really, really small for my age. She came up to me and talked to me like I was a little girl. She was like, "Oh, is this your first class? And how old are you?" And I looked at her, and I was like, "I'm 13. She was 10 or 11 at the time and was like, "Oh, sorry." But it was that supportive relationship that I realized is so much a part of the ballet world that people don't get to see depicted. There are often these tropes about ballet being cutthroat and pitting girls against each other. That definitely wasn't my experience, and Catalina was a big part of my building confidence and learning from her. When people think of ballet, they think it's like the movie Black Swan. Everyone's out to get everyone else and knock them off the stage. How far is that from the reality? I don't think those stories are coming from professional dancers. They're just made-up stories, and often not stories created by women. I think any young dancer would tell you that the friendships they develop while training or in a company are such a big part of why dancers dance. It's such a physical, intimate environment to be in. Can you elaborate? I've always seen ballerinas as being sort of icy and regal, but you say that's a false stereotype, that you're huggers. Yes, it's about the aesthetic, but we're also all practically naked around each other most of the time. It's a very vulnerable position to be in. The studio has always been the most sacred and vulnerable place for me to be in, and so it's really important that you're surrounded by people you can trust and depend on, which organically happens because everyone's in the same boat. Being a part of a professional company, you travel the world together. I typically spend more time with these dancers than I do my husband and my family. I've been in American Ballet Theatre for almost 20 years now, and have lived and experienced so many ups and downs and journeys with these people. In the book, I really wanted to highlight the beauty of ballet and the camaraderie and the mentorship that's organically structured into it, whether it's your ballet coach or your teacher or your artistic director. You often say, "This is for the little brown girls." And in Bunheads, many of the dancers depicted are girls of color. As the first black principal dancer with American Ballet Theatre, can you say why that's important? It's not that all little girls don't matter or all little boys don't matter. But these are the people that have been excluded and underrepresented and told they're not beautiful and that they can't dance ballet. So while the book is for everyone, I felt a responsibility to highlight those who have been excluded, to make them feel special, to empower them, so they can say, "Wow, this is for me too." You talk a lot about wanting to expand the small, pretty insular community of ballet. And perhaps to that end, you danced at a Taylor Swift concert, which was so beautiful, by the way. Thank you. Thought goes into all of my collaborations, whether it's endorsement deals or coming together with other artists. But always the larger goal is to reach a broader fan base, or a fan base that ballet doesn't necessarily organically reach. Prince was the first artist who introduced you to an audience outside ballet. Yes, he introduced me to the world. And to have someone of his stature have respect and understanding for what I did, I think that's first and foremost. I wasn't a backup dancer. I was an artist performing with him, and it really changed my whole perception of even how I saw myself outside of the ballet realm, where we're often not treated on that same level as other artists. That changed my whole trajectory of how I think about what I do and about knowing my worth. And so working with someone like Taylor, who is so important, I think, for this generation of girls, and understanding their power and, of course, her incredibly huge fan base, it just made perfect sense. And having her respect for ballet, that ballet dancers are equally important in our culture and community, that was number one. Tell us about Swans for Relief and how dancers are dealing with COVID-19 and not being able to perform in the usual venues before live audiences. In general, artists are good at taking advantage of whatever it is we have in our reach and creating art in any situation. And so many dancers are struggling financially right now, so Swans for Relief is helping to raise money to support them. We have 32 dancers from all over the world performing separately on video from their home countries, and it's available to watch on various social platforms. And there's a GoFundMe page. I have faith that we're going to survive this and come out with a better understanding of how to move forward and be more inclusive. But like I was saying before, when it comes to the relationships, one of the hardest things for dancers in this moment is not being surrounded by people. And I don't mean the audience, I mean in the studio. Besides the financial aspect, is the hardest part not being able to perform before an audience? It's more that ballet is such a physical art form. It's in our DNA to want to connect with the other dancers. We want to be close and physically connect with each other. The partners that we dance with in the corps de ballet, the group of girls you're breathing the same air with, trying to breathe at the same time and dance in unison, it's that physical and emotional connection we're missing now. Dancing solo just isn't the same. And then, of course, feeling that energy from a live audience can never be replaced. But I do think that this is a moment in time for us to be able to reach more people virtually, and we're connecting to so many more people than would typically come to the theater. I even think that there's a chance for us to change what theater is coming out of this. In what way? When I think about the Metropolitan Opera House and I think about La Scala in Milan and all of these big theaters, there's so much history connected to excluding people in those spaces. I'm not putting them down. They're clearly such a big part of culture. But I think that this is an opportunity for us to change that idea, whether it's creating outdoor spaces and communities that aren't included, or just to make these underserved communities feel like they are being invested in and they are part of this. Mentorship is important to you. In fact, you're now doing an online masterclass. Has Twyleth Art been a mentor? She's been a huge inspiration. I've been working with her for 20 years. I think I was 16 years old the first time she set a ballet on me when I was just a summer program student at ABT. To this day, I still go to her house often, and we're working together on several projects. It's always been important for me to see the artists who have come before me and know their struggles, know what's happening inside of them and what I can learn from their experiences. Twyla's autobiography, Push Comes to Shove, is amazing, as is her recent book, Keep It Moving, on dealing with an aging mind and body. What else do you like to read? I'm pretty all over the place. It came out a couple of years ago, but I'm really loving Trevor Noah's Born a Crime. To read about the biracial experience of a person from another culture is fascinating. And I always keep going back to The Power of Now by Eckhart Tolle, which keeps me grounded and has been so relevant at many stages of my life. It's always like reading it for the first time. Our next article by Jen McGuire is titled, I Raised Four Sons as a Single Mom. Now that they're grown, I'm off to Europe. I'm going to live in Europe for 4 months starting in January. I've been raising four sons on my own for the past 16 years, and now my youngest is moving out, and I don't know what I'm supposed to do with the rest of this life. I'm taking a month for each loss, the greatest loss I've ever experienced, because I lost those boys of mine to their adult selves. And I lost the only version of me who makes sense to anyone all at the same time. When I try to think beyond these months ahead, my mind goes blank. I hit a wall I have no clue how to climb beyond. A wall I knew I was approaching, but remains insurmountable nonetheless. On the other side of that wall lives a new mother I have no clue how to be. A peripheral mother, a phone call on Sundays and turkey at Thanksgiving kind of mother. I don't recognize this woman. I don't even know how to want to recognize this woman. I'm going to try to meet this unwelcome new mom I'm supposed to be in Europe. I will live in Italy for 2 months, and then France, and then one extra as yet to be chosen location that I've decided to call Dealer's Choice for the sake of spontaneity. At the end of this trip, I'm flying my sons over to me as sort of rejoining of our family. They will bring their girlfriends and their own agendas. I know this. I know they'll never feel like mine the way they did just months ago. But still, we're going. I can barely afford it, have almost no savings in the bank, and no extra income to fall back on. But still, I'm going. This trip is my epic maternal pause. My moment to exhale when all I've been doing is holding my breath for so long. This was the first year in almost 20 years when I have not had to consult a school supply list at Staples or check flyers for all the buy one, get one shoe sales and hope for acceptable styles. The other day I started to rummage through backpacks and winters and realized I don't need to buy a new backpack this year. The rest of the world went back to school, but not us. The moment left me mute with shock. Stunned by the depth of my mourning, standing in the parking lot, holding my key fob, looking off into a vacant future I have no way of predicting. Most of my life, I have been growing boys. I'm not even someone who likes to do math, and lately all I can think of are the numbers of my life. First son at 21, second at 23, third at 27, fourth at 28, single mom by 30, two or more jobs at a time for the past 15 years, one dog bought in the first grip of divorce guilt, a dog who is now 16 and will most likely live forever. One cat who ran away when he realized we were never going to be a good fit. Thousands upon thousands of dollars spent on renting at least 7 homes, probably more. Hundreds of hours of volunteering at their schools so the teachers wouldn't hold our financial situation or persistent lack of a positive male influence against my kids. And now it's all pretty much over. All of the decisions based on we five, decisions I thought I was making based on my own preferences, but I'm just now realizing that I haven't the slightest idea what I prefer, small town or big city. It depends on what the kids want and what I can afford for them. Economical car or gas-guzzling SUV? The boys are so tall, so I better go with the SUV. Single or dating? Good luck to any man who enters the realm of we five. Therefore, I'm moving to Europe, not to date, not to become someone else, but to wander around and uncoil the parts of my insides that have been coiled around those boys for my entire adult life. I'm not the only mother who has experienced this entanglement. It's common for mothers to become addicted and over-identified with being busy, says clinical psychotherapist Amy Deacon. In many ways, we feel lost without the constant need to be needed, and are terrified of the day our babes no longer depend on us. But in reality, this is such an accomplishment. We have achieved exactly what we were meant to do, but now we need to learn and be examples for our children, how to not be afraid of change, but rather embrace the silence with patience and curiosity. So I'm off to see things and figure out what I was like as me and me only. Will I enjoy living in a little village outside of Rome? I plan to embrace a little silence, stretch out my shoulders, and learn how to like my own quiet nothingness. If all goes well, I might even get a life-affirming compliment from one handsome Italian man, preferably while driving a Vespa and wearing a mid-calf skirt and ballet flats. Next, I'm off to Avignon for a month, the gateway to Provence. My French is already halfway acceptable, and croissants exist, so my hopes are high for a temporary life in France. The city boasts a population of just under 100,000 people. Perhaps I'll develop a taste of city-ish existence. A studio, a bicycle with a basket, perhaps one or two charming strangers who will become my sidekicks if I'm lucky. I could learn to bake a proper baguette and develop an appreciation for wine beyond my canned rosé. Maybe I will find the part of me I'm not yet ready to meet somewhere else. In Croatia, on a beach in Spain, in Ireland, or an island in Greece where I can sing the entire soundtrack to Mamma Mia. Who knows? All I know at the moment is this. My journey has been coming for a long time. Ever since I gave birth to my first golden boy and looked at him and thought, what will I be when you go? How will I survive? Who will I be? I have never been a grown-up without my boys. Without these people who have always been mine right down to their knuckles. But it's time to let them be grown-ups without me. Our next article by Deanna Janes is titled Inside Natalia Grace Barnett's Real-Life Orphan Case of Ukrainian Adoption Gone Wrong. Here's a doozy. Did a girl's parents force their adopted daughter to say she was an adult and then abandon her? Or was she actually an adult sociopath pretending to be a child and actively trying to kill them? It's a question Dr. Mehmet Oz poses on his true crime series, but it's not a hypothetical. It's entirely real. In a bizarre story that spins a yarn echoing that 2009 horror movie starring Vera Farmiga and Peter Sarsgaard, Orphan, this gripping tale is actually a real-life case currently making international headlines. Indiana parents Michael and Christine Barnett are accused of abandoning their 8-year-old daughter in Lafayette when they moved with their 3 biological children to Canada. However, the now divorced couple claim that their adopted Ukrainian daughter with dwarfism, Natalia Grace, was actually a 22-year-old woman who tried to murder them on multiple occasions. Like Dr. Oz, who invited Michael Barnett and his attorney, Terrence Kennard, onto his show, True Crime, to get the truth, we're attempting to unravel this mystery. Below is a timeline of everything we know. Natalia arrived in the United States in 2008. As reported by USA Today, Natalia told a Tippecanoe County Sheriff's deputy that she came to the States in 2008 as part of an adoption program. This is according to a probable cause affidavit. She also says that she has a rare form of dwarfism. It's characterized by deformities before birth that include spine, hip, and knee malformations, as well as ocular abnormalities. Michael and Christine Barnett adopted Natalia in 2010. Originally set to adopt a little girl from Haiti, the Barnett's plans were halted due to the area's massive earthquake. Later in April 2010, Michael told Dr. Oz that the couple was contacted by an adoption agency in Florida, saying they'd like to pair them with a Ukrainian girl. According to Michael, it was a hasty process. USA Today reports that Natalia's records initially indicated that she was born in 2003. According to Children's Hospital records, a physician examined her in 2010 and estimated her age to be about 8 years old. 2 years later, the hospital did its own testing and approximated Natalia to be 11. However, in June 2012, the Barnetts, with the court judge's approval, changed Natalia's age from 8 to 22, with birth records indicating that Natalia was born in 1989, making her 30 years old today. Michael says one of the benefits of changing her age was so that she could be lawfully admitted to a psychiatric hospital to get the care she needed. But what made the Barnetts believe Natalia wasn't a child in the first place? The Barnetts said they saw red flags from day one. According to the Daily Mail, Christine, who is a famed parenting author and motivational speaker, began doubting Natalia's age immediately after the adoption. On Dr. Oz's show, Michael elaborated that on their first night together, Christine was giving Natalia a bath and noticed that she had full pubic hair. Later, Michael claimed the couple learned of Natalia hiding her menstrual cycle. According to USA Today, Christine also alleged that she became fearful for her life as Natalia threatened to kill her and her family on more than one occasion. On Dr. Oz's show, Michael explained that Natalia was caught pouring Pine Sol into Christine's coffee. After she was confronted on the matter, Michael says Natalia simply said, "I'm trying to kill you." The family took the girl to professionals for evaluation. While at the stress center, she was documenting, she was telling doctors, she was telling therapists, she was writing down in her notepad, "Not only am I trying to kill Christine, but I'm going to kill the brothers too. Here's how I'm going to do it. Here's what I'm going to do with their bodies," Michael told Dr. Oz. The family moved to Canada in 2013 without Natalia. Something of a child prodigy, the Barnett's eldest son, 12-year-old Jacob Barnett, began getting media attention as a physics wonder kid at Purdue University, Indianapolis. He was featured in a segment on 60 Minutes and even gave a TED Talk. In 2013, Jacob was accepted to the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics in Waterloo, Ontario, so the family up and moved to Canada, leaving Natalia at home. Upon release from the stress center, where caretakers agreed Natalia was an adult, Michael told Dr. Oz, "We helped get her set up in an apartment near the town that we live in. We paid her first 3 months' rent. We set her up with disability, Social Security, food stamps. I checked on her a couple of times a week. She was fine. The Barnetts divorced in 2014. Michael filed, according to USA Today, but divorce proceedings are only the beginning of his courtroom headaches. A new family filed for guardianship of Natalia in 2016. Natalia got evicted from her Lafayette apartment and told authorities she hasn't seen her parents since their move up north. Meanwhile, a neighbor said that the girl attended classes at Lafayette Adult Resource Academy, but abruptly quit going. According to Dr. Oz, Natalia is now living with another family in Indiana who in 2016 petitioned to be Natalia's guardians. But to make that happen, they needed her old birth records, and that process required contacting the Barnetts. Michael said he showed up at the guardianship hearing with several of Natalia's past healthcare professionals and documentation, and the judge ruled that Natalia was indeed an adult. The case was dismissed. Christine and Michael Barnett were arrested and charged in 2019. In what can only be described as a twist, Michael reportedly admitted to police that he believed Natalia was a minor in July of 2013. It's not so. It's taken completely out of context, Michael said. However, day one, I thought she was 6. Day two, I thought she was 9. Despite the differing accounts, arrest warrants soon followed, and the pair was charged with 2 counts of felony neglect of a dependent. Michael Barnett talked with Dr. Oz to clear his name. On the show, Michael, accompanied by his attorney, told his story and answered tough questions from the host. He also said he thinks Natalia may not even be Ukrainian. She had no accent, couldn't speak Ukrainian, and had no memory of growing up in Ukraine, Michael said. It all makes for one bewildering case stumping the court of public opinion. Natalia Grace denies that she conned the Barnetts. While the Barnetts have certainly had their say in the media, Natalia's voice had been missing from the story. Now she's clearing the air in an interview with Dr. Phil. She's painted you as an evil dwarf who's going to poison their coffee or stab them in their sleep, Dr. Phil tells Natalia. They say you scammed them, lied about your age, and terrorized them. But Natalia insists that it's not true at all and says she wants people to know her side of the story. During the interview, her hand is held by Cynthia Manns, who sits on the couch alongside her husband, Antoine Manns. The Indiana couple have adopted Natalia, according to an unconfirmed report from the Daily Mail. Dr. Phil seems to remain skeptical. A 6 or 7-year-old child living in an apartment alone for a year? That's just not believable to me. Natalia's face shows bemused surprise as Dr. Phil breaks it down like this. I guess it comes down to whether or not you were an evil psychopath demon child who's come over here to murder everybody. Well, when you put it that way. Our next article by Elena Nicolou is titled Christy Smirl Designs Private Libraries for the Stars. Over a year into our cooped-up existence, my family and I have taken to playing a game. It's called Extra Room. The rules are simple. If an extra room materialized in our house overnight, what will we do with it? For me, the answer is easy, because it's always been the same. I'd wave my wand to get my own library, the kind you see on Pinterest, with high shelves and a cozy chair for one. In addition to books, I'd also like a dollop of privacy, pretty please. And in that alternate reality, I'd summon Christy Smirl, the owner and creator of Foxtail Books, to conjure up dark wood and antique tome-filled shelves to rival the ones in Beauty and the Beast. A private librarian, Smirl has been creating custom book collections for big-name clients since she started her company in 2016. So big that she can't actually share their identities. She can only give us teasers on what she curates for them. There was the retired NFL player with a sleek sports library, the professional chef who wanted her cookbooks to live alongside her kitchen, and the LA couple who erected a wall of floor-to-ceiling books for their 12-year-old daughter. Most of Smirl's clients find her through referrals from pros in the design world. Others track her down through Google, wondering if a service like the one Smirl offers even exists. People with a large book collection or a house they would love to have filled with one search the web to solve those problems. And here I am, she says. Unlike other dream jobs, like a novelist or interior decorator, Smurl had to invent this one herself. While private librarians certainly exist, like Gwyneth Paltrow's go-to book curator, Thatcher Wine, known for his gorgeous custom-made spines, Smurl is set apart in the not-crowded field by her master's degree in library science, which allows her to create bespoke libraries that are designed not just to look good, but to be read from. Thanks to her background as a librarian, Smurl feels confident in being able to create quintessential collections on any topic. "It's not my job to have read every book in the world. It's my job to be resourceful," she says. Smurl's research skills especially emerge when scouring for the ideal book in its ideal edition. She cites the many versions of the classic Pride and Prejudice as an example. You can have your Jane Austen and still maintain a particular look in a room, a bright red paperback or a classy leather-bound one, she explains. After interviewing clients to discern their needs and particular tastes or genre preferences, Smurl turns to an array of resources to assemble their fantasy library. Publishers, bookstores, consumer reviews, subject experts in specific fields, book fairs, museum shops, and her own network of connections for recommendations. Smurl also includes special books, like British editions, antiquarian books, signed copies, or out-of-print critical darlings, so the finished library doesn't feel impersonal, as if it were copy and pasted out of a bookstore. The hunt, as she calls it, takes her from rare book fairs to eBay. She recently found a flannel-bound copy of The Call of the Wild, which might serve as a centerpiece for a library with a mountain vibe. Clearly, Smurl's task is far more complex than creating the Instagram-worthy shelves I so crave. If you were going to do that, you'd buy books by the foot, which is a service too, Smurl explains. Instead, people who seek Smurl's expertise are in search of works that'll actually spark their interest. Given the equal weight Foxtail Books places on form and function, Smurl says private librarian isn't exactly the right term for her role. Smurl straddles four different jobs: project manager, interior designer, rare bookseller, and finally librarian. Actually, make that six jobs. After some deliberation, she adds psychologist and couples therapist to the list. That happens when you're helping people decide what to get rid of and what their priorities are in a room, Smurl says, recalling the time she was hired to split a couple's pre-existing collection between their two homes during the pandemic. The couple's charged interaction points to the heart of Smurl's art form. She's technically organizing bookshelves, but she's actually helping create a sense of identity. "Books are the places that your mind and heart have been," she says. "There's a reason that when we are in someone's house, we're curious about what's on the shelves. We're wondering who they are." Designing luxury at-home libraries wasn't originally Smurl's plan. Growing up in Denver, Colorado, she didn't actually have much of a plan at all, though her mother always knew her daughter was destined for a degree in library sciences. As is so often the case, it took years before Smurl realized her mother was right. While studying at the University of Denver, Smurl met an aspiring professional librarian in the graduate school. Suddenly, while speaking to her new acquaintance about her courses, Smurl heard the click of her life coming together. "That sounds perfect for my brain," Smurl recalls thinking. "I love culture and the arts. I'm a tactile person, and I love books." She, too, went on to receive a degree in library science. After moving to Jackson Hole, Wyoming with her then-boyfriend, now husband, Smurl was hired as a reference librarian at the picturesque mountain town's only public library. Located in the richest county in the United States, Jackson Hole has become a mecca for wealthy Americans in search of skiing, stunning views, and tax havens. The public library's clientele was in the market for luxury services, and one such person gave Smurl the idea for her own. 5 years before founding Foxtail Books, a patron at Teton County Library asked Smurl whether she knew anyone who could help organize her personal bookshelves. Smurl volunteered and spent the weekend previewing what would become her business. "In a way, that woman made up the job. I enjoyed it so much that I spent another 5 years at the library after that thinking, what else could I do with these skills? What else could I do that would be more of a creative outlet for me?" Smurl says. In 2016, with the support of her husband and a web of connections, Smurl felt ready to launch a business in what she felt was a hole in the luxury services market. "I didn't have anyone to emulate. I was creating it on my own, but I thought, I think if I take this seriously and really go for it, then I can make something of it. No one's doing it in this precise way. I'm going to be the one, she said. Smurl eventually hopes to open an office on the East Coast. Other dreams include building a yacht library and one in a New York penthouse. Anywhere there's an incredible home, I picture the incredible library that belongs there, Smurl says. Now Smurl leads a busy, jet-setting existence, at least she did before the pandemic. But one thing hasn't changed since her days as a public librarian. After all that time dealing with shelves, the ones Smurl cares least about are her own. She rarely posts shelfies on social media and admittedly isn't attached to her personal collection. A librarian at her core, Smurl derives the most satisfaction from passing books she enjoys to people who will appreciate them equally. If I love reading something, I love passing it along, she says. Books have such long lives and should live in different places. Through her job, she celebrates the transient nature of books. Her office is a way station for books that will one day live in home libraries around the country. Chances are those libraries will not be their final destination. When Smurl meanders around antiquarian fairs for her clients, she's touching books that are at times hundreds of years old. Books tell us stories, but we only know part of their stories as they move from shelf to shelf, from life to life. For that reason, we'll add a seventh job title to Smurl's list, Shepherd, herding books from one place to the next. Our next article by Elena Nicolou is titled Netflix's documentary A Secret Love tells the epic story of a 72-year romance. Our advice? Don't watch A Secret Love, the Netflix documentary, without tissues. Lots of them. In the exquisite documentary produced by Hollywood's Ryan Murphy, Pat Hinchel and Terry Donahue reflect on their 6 decades together. For much of that time, Hinchel and Donahue kept their relationship a secret. They felt they had no other choice. Hinchel and Donahue, who affectionately call each other nicknames like My Honey throughout the film, began dating in 1947, a time when lesbians were arrested in bar raids and homosexuality was practically verboten. They lived discreetly as a couple in Chicago for decades. We didn't think we were brave. We thought we were living a normal, happy, pleasant life. It was very easy because we were so happy and so glad to be together, Hinchel tells OprahMag.com. Filmed over the course of 4 years and directed by Donahue's great-nephew, Chris Bolin, A Secret Love captures a bittersweet truth for the couple. At the same moment they could finally live openly, life became harder than ever. As the documentary explores, before she passed away last year, Donahue, once a professional athlete, could hardly hold an object due to complications for Parkinson's disease. Hinchel, 4 years Donahue's junior, was pressured by her partner's large family to move to a nursing home, but didn't want to lose their hard-won independence. After living as a couple for decades, breaking societal norms for the sake of their own happiness, Hinchel and Donahue confronted a challenge not even they could surmount. Aging. In A Secret Love, the couple voyages into the final phase of their relationship side by side, as always. Here's what you need to know about the true story that inspired A Secret Love. Pat Hinchel and Terry Donahue began dating in 1947. The couple got together in an era when queer relationships were largely secret, at best, and dangerous at worst. In the 40s, you had to be very careful, Donahue explained in the documentary. The women both grew up in Saskatchewan, a province of Canada, and met while playing ice hockey in Moose Jaw, Canada. At the time, Donahue, then 22, was spending most of her days in the U.S. as a catcher for the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. Before meeting each other, Donahue and Hinchel dated men. In fact, Hinchel had even been engaged. But they knew what they felt for one another right away. True love, Hinchel, who was 18 when she met Donahue, says. The couple moved to Chicago, where they lived for most of their lives. There, they also amassed a group of friends, mostly in the LGBTQ community, with whom they could be themselves. We had incredibly wonderful friends. We just loved them, Hinchel says. They were in their 80s when they opened up to their family. Less than a decade ago, when Donahue was in her late 80s, she finally told her sprawling family in Canada the truth about her relationship with Henschel. Bolin recalls the moment his great-aunts got candid with him. "We were having a rum and coke in the living room, and they said, 'We have something to tell you. We're gay,'" Bolin tells OprahMag.com. "There was a pause, and I said, 'I think this is wonderful.' They felt comfortable by my reaction. The floodgates opened, and they proceeded to tell me all their stories." From that moment on, Bolin, an actor, wanted to turn their story into a film, even if his great-aunts didn't quite understand his enthusiasm. "They genuinely feel like they lived their true lives. What's so interesting about that?" Bolin says. But throughout the film, we see why it's such a powerful story. Terry Donahue's career inspired the movie A League of Their Own. A Secret Love isn't the first time Donahue's life has gotten the big screen treatment. She was part of the all-women's baseball league that inspired the 1992 movie A League of Their Own. According to Bolin, she also served as a consultant for the film. Donahue was a catcher and utility midfielder for the Peoria Red Wings, a team in the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. The league, which existed from 1943 to 1954, was formed by baseball execs as a response to World War II. While the majority of men were fighting overseas, women kept the ball game going. And yes, Donahue and her teammates really did wear those short skirts and tunics seen in A League of Their Own. Terry Donahue passed away in 2019. Terry died at a nursing home in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, at the age of 93. She and Henschel were together for 72 years. Henschel is still alive and lives in a nursing home in Canada. She and Donahue's niece, Diana Bolin, often think of how Donahue would process the documentary's release. "Terry would be surprised and pleased and happy to know that it's happening," Henschel says. "She'd say, 'I'm glad I was a part of this.'" Before she passed, Donahue was able to see an early version of the documentary. Auntie Terry's blue eyes just beamed. She chuckled and said, "I can't believe anybody would be interested in our life." She was so thrilled and just kept chuckling, Diana tells OprahMag.com. They remained madly in love their entire lives. Diana was with the couple frequently after they moved to Canada and can attest to their unending affection. "They were so close. It was such a strong love. I've never seen anything like it, ever," she says. Their bond is also evident throughout the documentary, where they share constant compliments and kisses. A Secret Life even features their wedding. "The world needs examples like this, whether you're gay or straight," producer Brandon Mason tells us. Filmmakers think A Secret Love is a universal story. A Secret Love pairs Henschel and Donahue's extraordinary romance with the struggles of aging and caring for elderly loved ones. We have these two remarkable, independent women who relied on no one their entire lives, who now had to look to other people to help them, Mason says. "Every single human being is dealing or will deal with somebody in their lives getting older. That is very emotional," producer Alexa L. Fogel adds. By profiling his great aunts, Bolin hopes A Secret Love combats major ageism in the U.S. "We highlight these two beautiful women who are in their late 80s and early 90s, but they are relevant, and they are important, and they do have something to say. They don't need to be put away and forgotten about. They need to be celebrated," Bolin says. Our next article by Elena Nicolou is titled, "Tyler Perry Asks Audiences to Refuse Hate in a Moving Oscars Acceptance Speech." Tyler Perry urged audiences to refuse hate during a moving speech at the 93rd Academy Awards on April 25th. The entertainment mogul was honored with a humanitarian award given out periodically to an individual in the motion picture industry whose humanitarian efforts have brought credit to the industry. Past honorees of the Jean Hersholt Humanitarian Award include Oprah, who was honored in 2011, and Angelina Jolie in 2013. Perry has long been known for his acts of generosity, which have included fundraising for social justice causes to paying for people's Walmart layaways during the holiday season. He was also recognized for helping to create a safe work environment under COVID-era restrictions. His studio was among the first to resume filming. After taking the stage at LA's Union Station to accept the award, Perry delivered a speech that summed up his philosophy and hopefully inspired others to think similarly. When I set out to help someone, it is my intention to do just that. I'm not trying to do anything other than meet somebody at their humanity, he said. While speaking, Perry credited his own life experiences with the empathetic approach to charity. Before he was a billionaire with a 330-acre film studio in Atlanta, Perry endured struggles including homelessness and an abusive childhood. Perry shared a story about encountering a homeless woman outside his studio 17 years ago. After offering the woman money, she replied that what she really needed was a new pair of shoes. Her request made sense to Perry. I remember being homeless and having one pair of shoes and they were bent at the heel, he recalled. I took her into the studio. She was hesitant to go in. We go to wardrobe and there were all these boxes and things on the wall. We had to stand on the middle of the floor. We find some shoes. I'm waiting for her to look up. All this time she's looking down. Finally she looks up and there are tears in her eyes. She says, thank you. Thank you, Jesus. My feet are off the ground. She said, I thought you'd hate me for asking. I said, how can I hate you when I used to be you, Perry said. Perry said his mother, Willie Maxine Perry, who died in 2009, first taught him the lesson in empathy he relayed on the Oscar stage. Willie was born in Louisiana during the Jim Crow era. Through events like the murder of Emmett Till in 1955 and the killing of four black schoolgirls during a church bombing in Birmingham, Maxine learned the cost of hatred. My mother taught me to refuse hate. She taught me to refuse blanket judgment. And in this time, with all the internet and social media and algorithms and everything that wants us to think a certain way, he said, it is my hope that all of us will teach our kids to refuse hate. During this time, Perry implored audiences to resist prejudice and biases. I've refused to hate someone because they are Mexican, they are black, they are white, or LGBTQ. I refuse to hate someone because they are a police officer. I refuse to hate someone because they are Asian. I hope that we refuse hate, he concluded. Our next article by Norman Venemy is titled Archaeologists Discover the Location of Harriet Tubman's Childhood Home. Earlier this week, the Lieutenant Governor of Maryland announced that archaeologists had discovered the location of a house where Harriet Tubman spent part of her childhood. Buried artifacts, including broken pottery, glass, and a button, help pinpoint the site of the former dwelling on land once owned by Ben Ross, the father of the renowned abolitionist and Underground Railroad conductor. Tubman, whose maiden name was Aramet Ross, she later took her mother's first name, was born into slavery in March of 1822. She was forced to work as a nursemaid, field hand, and woodcutter. Although she remained enslaved, she married a freed slave named John Tubman. In 1949, when she learned she might be sold, she escaped alone to Philadelphia in freedom. The following year, Tubman disguised herself and returned to Maryland and helped her sister and two others escape. Over the next 10 years, she returned a dozen times, freeing some 70 people. A group of slave owners offered a $40,000 reward for her capture or murder. The discovery of her childhood home is an important addition to the continuing scholarship of the life of one of America's bravest and most daring citizens. Dr. Julie Shabitsky, the lead archaeologist on the dig, said in the statement, "She would have spent time here as a child, but also she would have come back and been living here with her father in her teenage years, working alongside him. This was the opportunity she had to learn about how to navigate and survive in the wetlands and the woods. We believe this experience was able to benefit her when she began to move people to freedom." During the Civil War, Tubman served in the Union Army as a nurse, scout, and spy. After the war, she applied for and was denied a pension for her service. In the 1890s, Congress passed a bill awarding her $20 a month. She settled in Auburn, New York, and opened her home to orphans and others in need, founding what would eventually become the Harriet Tubman Home for Indigent Aged Negroes. The newly discovered site will become a stop on the Harriet Tubman Byway, a 125-mile trail that includes more than 30 sites related to Tubman's life and achievements. Tubman died in 1913. In 2016, President Obama announced that her face would appear on newly minted $20 bills. That effort was delayed, but on his first day in office, President Biden's press secretary announced the initiative would resume. "It's important that our money reflects the history and diversity of our country," she said. Our next article by Paula Lee is titled, "How Dolly Parton Inspired a Cold Shoulder COVID-19 Vaccine Top Trend." Just when you thought the cold shoulder top that reached peak popularity around 2010 was making a slow retreat from the sartorial landscape, it has resurrected itself as a pandemic fashion trend. Presenting the vaccine top, peekaboo details and shoulderless silhouettes not only make a fabulous, easy-access outfit for your appointment and beyond, but they also allow you to get your shot without partially disrobing in front of a stranger. Who said fashion can't be functional? While the rest of us comfy-clothed mortals might stick to the same t-shirt we've had on rotation since 2020 to get our coveted COVID-19 vaccine, Dolly Parton inspired many with a practical yet stylish alternative when she went in for her first dose in March. Naturally, she glammed things up. Miss Parton is a mega-style icon after all. Leave it to the vaccine fairy godmother, who donated $1 million to COVID-19 research that led to the Moderna breakthrough, to turn cutouts into a pro-health fashion statement. All eyes were on her sparkly sweater of choice with perfectly placed spaces for needle entry when she posted her celebratory image on Instagram. Even Hillary Clinton couldn't resist getting in on the vaccine fashion commentary, subtly reminding us with a throwback photo that she started the cold shoulder trend back in 1993 at her inaugural White House state dinner as First Lady. For those who don't recall, before the exposed shoulder gained popularity in the early aughts as a going-out uniform, the former Secretary of State wore a body-hugging Donna Karen gown with daring cutouts to the official event, and it was a bit of a scandal. Often credited in the industry for pioneering the cold shoulder as we know it today, Karen designed the garment in the 1990s with working women in mind. She likes to note, regardless of age or body type, a woman's shoulders are always attractive, making them an especially alluring body part to bear. Christie Brinkley also embraced the revitalized trend when she sported an asymmetric cutout knit for her final dose in March. Indeed, the cold shoulder is universally flattering and versatile silhouette to wear. Though typically not a fan of full-on arm exposure, Oprah also wasn't afraid to show a sliver of skin in a portrait for The Hollywood Reporter. Of course, her elegant blouse is certainly a more, shall we say, straightforward choice than the look Amy Schumer wore for her March vaccine appointment. The comedian dressed up in a sequin cocktail number with an apparent DIY cutout and encouraged others to don their fanciest attire as well. We don't necessarily recommend hacking up your evening gowns, but we do agree that the cold shoulder is the top du jour for the most exciting event of the year, destination vaccination. Of course, fashion is cyclical and fickle, and while designers have favored the related off-the-shoulder and one-shoulder necklines over the past few years, some may have predicted the desire for inoculation style. Prada presented thin turtlenecks with holes in its spring 2021 collection, while Michael Kors included a sumptuous cutout cashmere sweater in his fall 2021 runway show. The cold shoulder has officially returned, and we love a good comeback story. To close up our show this week, Oprah shares one of the biggest aha moments she's ever had. "Hi, everybody. Back in 2018, I did a story for 60 Minutes about how trauma impacts children. Dr. Bruce Perry was one of the experts who shared this idea that when we're dealing with kids with behavioral issues who are acting out, people often say, 'What's wrong with that kid?' But the real question he says we should be asking is, 'What happened to them?' I have to tell y'all, that was one of the biggest aha moments I've ever had. I realize this question does not just apply to children, but to all of us. Because as Dr. Perry, who is both a neuroscientist and a psychiatrist, often says, what happened to you shapes your worldview. So I've since had so many major epiphanies about my own life. I am certainly less judgmental and more empathetic to others because that question is now at the forefront of my interactions. I have a better understanding of other people. I know not to think what's wrong, but what happened to the person to make them behave the way that they do. That is why I decided to co-author What Happened to You? Conversations about Trauma, Resilience, and Healing with Dr. Bruce Perry. And so the big thing I learned while co-authoring this book is that it all comes down to how you were loved as a child and the question of whether you got what you needed to form a worthy sense of self. Not what your brothers and sisters did, and why getting what you need in the first 2 months is just crucial. 0 to 6 is when you basically become you, and those first 2 months are when the foundation for how the synapses in the brain that allow you to connect, to regulate, to feel safe are formed. And the earlier the trauma occurs in your life, the harder it is to overcome. Dr. Perry says, the basic finding is that the experiences of the first 2 months of life have a disproportionately important impact on your long-term health and development. This has to do with the remarkably rapid growth of the brain early in life and the organization of all those important core regulatory networks. If in the first 2 months of life a child experiences high adversity with minimal relational buffering, but was then put into a healthier environment for the next 12 years, their outcomes were worse than the outcomes of children who had low adversity and healthy relational connection in the first 2 months, but then spent the next 12 years in high adversity. Think of that. The child with only 2 months, the first 2 months of really bad experiences of their life, does worse than the child with almost 12 years of bad experiences, all because of the timing. Dr. Perry says that neglect is as toxic as trauma. He also says that a key aspect of what happened to you is what did not happen for you. So the question to think about, this week I want you to think about, is what attention, what nurturing, what touch, what reassurance did you get as a child? In other words, what love did you get or not get? I want to know, what happened to you? We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.